I feel that I was sold a lie. Sold a lie by my education system. That a major historical untruth, it was not true that Palestine was a desert until the Israelis turned up in 1948 and that they turned an empty desert into orange groves.
Okay, so my next guest is one of the UK's most acclaimed historians. He's the best-selling author of 12 books and a well-respected name in British media. He spent much of his career and life writing about empire, colonialism, and the legacies of power. And now he's protesting, posting online, calling out the UK government and saying that it's complicit in a genocide. That's where we find William Dalrymple today. In recent months, Dalrymple has emerged as one of the few high-profile British public intellectuals publicly and consistently denouncing Israel's war in Gaza. And so, on this episode of Real Talk, I'm going to go sit down with William to talk about all of those things, but also his own writings from Israel-Palestine and why he chooses to continue speaking up. William Dalrymple.
Very nice to
welcome
be
to
back.
Real Talk.
Welcome to my garden.
Thank you. So we're at your house. We're in your garden in London. You've made us tea. Let me tell you, do you know how many people back in the office are jealous right now? Even more jealous when they see the tea that you've made.
That's very nice today.
It's a real pleasure to host you, or you hosting us, one or the other.
Very nice to be here. I'm a big fan of Middle East, I have to say. For years, there was a very bad need for something like this, because there was a whole point of view that was simply not being put out by the mainstream media. And I'm a big fan and supporter of all you guys do.
So
very proud to be interviewed by you.
Oh, thank you. No, it's our pleasure. Let me, you know, look, the point of this conversation, there's a lot of things that we're going to get into. We're going to get into your writings as well from Israel-Palestine. But I think the point of it is to try and kind of capture what you have been going through as an acclaimed, a respected British historian, and finding your place in the world within everything that's been happening over the last 18, 19 months.
Sure.
And I specifically mean Gaza. So let me just get right to it with that question is, you know, you've been outspoken on the plight of the Palestinians for decades. This is not something that you've just started doing. But
I don't think I've been outspoken. I just said the truth.
But you've been writing about
something
it.
Which is occluded by the mainstream media and is not taught to the people of this country in their education system. I feel I don't think I've done anything remarkable or odd or extraordinary, but I think anyone who has been to the West Bank or Gaza and seen what the Palestinians have gone through, anyone who has witnessed with their own eyes the humiliations of people at checkpoints, the two different road systems, the way that settlements encroach into Palestinians' land, anyone that's ever met a Palestinian and had a taste of the subjugation they suffer, that's what I do. I know many writers who've been, for example, to the Palestine Festival of Literature and have come out fizzing with anger that they didn't know this earlier, that this had been omitted from their education. And I'm glad to say there are many of us who feel like this. And I think the more we can encourage people to go to the West Bank and meet Palestinians, it's difficult obviously to get anyone to get into Gaza at the moment, but you can still go easily to Ramallah or Jenin or Nablus and see that the kind of stuff which Palestinians are living through and living under. And you know, in 10 minutes you get it. Go through one checkpoint, see the way that the Palestinians are treated as subhuman, as animals often by the Israeli soldiers molesting and harassing them. You can't but feel angry. I spent a lot of my life writing about colonialism.
Yeah.
Partly because...
And the legacy of it as well.
Yeah, partly because what I experienced on my different trips to the West Bank nothing teaches you what it's like. Nothing in the world exists, as far as I know, in my travels, of one people subjecting another and colonizing and occupying their land and edging them out and restricting their freedoms in the way that you can see every day on a one-day trip to the West Bank.
So with that point in hand, how have been the last 18, 19 months been on you? Specifically when it comes to the fact that, like I said, you've been outspoken, that you've been writing about this, but also this fight for the plight of the Palestinians. How have the last 18, 19 months shaped you, let's say?
The time that I lived and worked in the Middle East was the mid-1990s through to about 2000. And at that time, I wrote this book, From the Holy Mountain, living not just in Jerusalem and traveling out both into Israel and into occupied West Bank, but also traveling all around Lebanon, Syria, Jordan, Egypt, Turkey, and really immersing myself deeply in Middle Eastern history and the history of the Byzantine empires and the Ottoman empires and all the different layers of history and civilization in the Middle East. And to a certain extent, it was a conscious decision I made around the turn of the millennium, around 2000, to move back to India, because this was actually upsetting me so much. I was feeling myself becoming possibly a little ranty about it, as people do. when you see the injustices suffered by the Palestinians, and yet it is not reflected in most of the media or the writings or the representation of the Middle East that you see in the media, you do find yourself becoming angry that these truths are being obscured, that people are not being given the same impression that you get when you go there. And for the last 20 odd years, my focus has been on India.
Yes.
But Gaza, in a sense, just pulled me straight back into, right. You can't just sit there writing about the British Raj when, you know, the iniquities of the British Raj, very similar systems of subjugation and colonization and oppression, are actually being put into place now. At this moment, I don't need to tell anyone from Middle East Eye, but at this moment, 2.1 million Palestinians in Gaza, who themselves are refugees, kicked out in 1948 at the Nakba. In 1948, 750,000 Palestinians were kicked out, largely from the Galilee, from Beit She'an, from Tiberias, from Acre, from Jaffa. Many of those found themselves on the sand dunes of Gaza. Now those people are being starved, shunted like cattle from pen to pen, bombed daily, having to queue up for what little aid is now being given in sort of what looks like barbed wire pens again, and many of them are being shot. It's a completely outrageous situation to happen anywhere, but it's particularly outrageous in a country that was a former British colony and which the situation today, whereby the Palestinians are a subject and occupied people, was largely the responsibility of the failures of British policy during the British Mandate. And which continue today with this current British government and the one before it, providing not just diplomatic cover, but also aircraft supplies, intelligence from the RAF, to a government which is very clearly committing major war crimes of the sort which we rightly condemn anywhere else in the world. Sometimes apologists for Israel talk as if Israel's being held to a higher standard than other countries. The opposite is true.
The opposite is true.
Israel is given a carte blanche to commit atrocities which, if they were committed by the Russians at this moment in Ukraine, the scenes we've seen of hospitals being serially bombed, hospital after hospital after hospital, children in tents burnt alive. These are horrific scenes, and I think, you know, one has a duty to speak out. You know, there are many people that know that region far more intimately than I do, but I still feel that in my 5 years' experience there, that I know more than 99% of people seem to, because our education system does not teach us this. There are many areas of history that you know, a guy who or a girl who's been through 10 years of British education can talk about quite confidently, but Palestine is absolutely out of the picture, or certainly was in my education. In fact, I was taught the opposite. I was of the generation that had geography textbooks, I remember them now, which taught me about how the Israelis came to the desert, the empty desert, and made the desert bloom and turn them into orange groves. So I feel, as many people do, I think, who have heard the Palestinian point of view and see what has happened to the Palestinians, I feel that I was sold a lie.
Sold a lie?
Sold a lie by my education system. That a major historical untruth. It was not true that Palestine was a desert until the Israelis turned up in 1948 and that they turned an empty desert into orange groves. Anyone who studies the history will discover that the Palestinians who are there today are a rich mix of all the peoples who have passed through that patch of land over the past 5,000 years. The DNA of the Palestinian Christians is almost identical to the DNA of bodies dug up from the Bronze Age in anywhere in that region. The only people that have a slightly higher DNA match to Bronze Age skeletons are the Samaritans, a tiny group of which only a few thousand left in the West Bank. Next down the line comes the Palestinian Muslims, and then Sephardic Jewish Israelis. So basically, these people are all cousins. And this is one of the great tragedies, just like the Protestants and the Christians, just like the Protestants and the Catholics in Northern Ireland are separated brothers who have finally learnt to live together since the Good Friday Agreements. I feel very strongly that we need to do all we can to encourage the Palestinians and the Israelis to come together, whether it's in one state or two states. Some way, there needs to be the equivalent of the Good Friday Agreement, a peace process which leads to the sharing of land. At the moment, the current government, very, very clearly, under Smotrich, Ben-Gavir and Netanyahu, are making it completely crystal clear that they are imminently about to evict and ethnically cleanse the 2.1 million Palestinians in Gaza. And they are, and their actions make it clear that a similar fate awaits those in the West Bank, of which there are 4 million. So enormous numbers of people stand to lose their land, their freedoms, their ability to live in their ancestral homes. One of the supreme human rights horrors of our time is unfolding before us, and our government is on the wrong side. We are selling aircraft parts, we are providing diplomatic cover, we are providing intelligence to the aggressors, to the IDF, and we're doing almost nothing to protect the Palestinians. To remind the government, in 1917 at the Balfour Declaration, a promise was made that the establishment of a Jewish homeland would not in any way undermine the civil and religious rights of the non-Jewish inhabitants of Palestine. That was the phrase in the Balfour Declaration. We sat on our hands when that promise was torn up in 1948, when 750,000 Palestinians were evicted from their homes. And right up to the present, the last government and this government, we are doing all we can to support Israel, even as it is planning a mass ethnic cleansing. So I feel it's a very serious moment. It's not a moment when you can sit and go and write about something else quietly in another country. Anyone that is aware of what's happening has to stand up and make their voices heard. And luckily, I mean, I do feel the tide is changing, that people from all walks of life are realizing what's going on and are supporting this cause. I have been speaking widely about it at rallies, but also at literary festivals across the country this summer, and I found incredible response. People have really got it now. And I've had enough.
I'm gonna get into that. Honestly, look, at this point, I'm taken aback by your passion. I forgot that I had a list of questions. I'm watching you speak.
I'm upset by this. Yeah.
No, absolutely. And I think that's coming across. Yeah. But let's take it kind of just one thing at a time. One of the things I found interesting, especially for people who don't live in the UK, you blaming the education system. Can we unpack that just a little bit? The
sure.
fact that it's you, what you're basically alluding to, or what you're saying, is that the proper history isn't being taught in British
Correct.
Education systems.
So, obviously, you can't teach kids everything.
Sure.
And we're here in Britain, in England, and the kids. It's right that the kids should learn about the Tudors, the Industrial Revolution, the spinning jenny, but. In my opinion, and this, I think this is true across the whole story of the British Empire, the way that the British subjected populations across the globe, we have an incredibly rosy idea about that in this country. We regard the British Empire as something benign, while at the same time looking at something like the German Empire, the Third Reich, or the Belgians in the Congo, or the French in Algeria, as appalling. But somehow we've sort of given ourselves a free pass. Somehow the British are different. Somehow British imperialism is this wonderful thing for which everyone should be grateful. Now, obviously, that's nonsense. Obviously, there are many, many things that happened from India, from Tasmania, from Canada, but also Palestine, which have led many indigenous peoples to either be wiped out in the case of the Tasmanian indigenous people, or the Caribs of the Caribbean, or to, in the case of the Palestinians, to suffer displacement and ethnic cleansing on a massive scale. Now, it's very important that the British people understand a measure of this. Obviously, you can't blame kids brought up in this country today for what their great-grandfathers did, but they should know about it. And when they go out into the world...
And you talked about it in one of your speeches.
I believe this very strongly. And this is not just about Palestine. It's true about India, too. I mean, one sees... I've lived in India for 40 years, and one sees Brits coming out imagining that they're going to be receive a rapturous welcome from the Indian people, who are only so grateful that
and
for 250 years. The reality is, it is quite chilled. It's a long time ago now for most people, and you know, and they're a polite nation. They're not going to be outrightly rude. But if Brits turn up and start singing the praises of Winston Churchill or Lord Curzon, you will upset people. And I, living there for as long as I have, and seeing generations of Brits just not realizing the minefields they're walking on, and simply not knowing the stories of the Bengal famine, where 6 million died in the Second World War, or what Lord Curzon did to Bengal in the partition of 1905, or what happened in Jallianwala Bagh, or what happened at the Battle of Plassey, or previous Bengal famines of the 1770s. None of this appears in our education system, and it's important we know this. But that, I think, is particularly true of Palestine at the present, because this is a bit of colonial history which is impinging every day on our news bulletins, every single day. And we are still participators in it, as the party held by the Israeli government in the British Museum 2 weeks ago let out, announced proudly how the British were providing RAF intelligence for IDF operations in Gaza, announced that they had doubled the number of arms sales to Israel since Keir Starmer got into power last summer. So there is a lot of education that needs to take place for people in this country to understand. I mean, the word Nakba, I'm sure, is something that would mean something to less than 1% of this country, maybe 2% of people. If you took a poll on high streets across the country, have you ever heard of the Nakba? Most people would shake their heads. And yet, you cannot understand what's happening in Gaza now. You cannot understand why the Palestinians are in the situation they are now, unless you understand about the Balfour Declaration, unless you understand about the Nakba in 1948, and the way that the British allowed the 85% of the indigenous population of Palestine to be cleared out of their lands.
On this specific note, William, because I find it interesting, we seldom hear British historians talk about this, and it's Britain's responsibility towards Palestine. But I have this great opportunity talking to you right now as a well-respected, well-acclaimed British historian. What is Britain's responsibility towards Palestine in 2025? Like, what is it today?
So, I mean, to lay it out very simply, in 1917,
yes,
Lloyd George, who had never been to Palestine, plus his Secretary of State, Arthur Balfour, who had never been to Palestine, neither of whom had indeed much grasp of what was going on anywhere in the Middle East.
And we're talking at a point when the British got Jerusalem from the Ottomans, basically.
So in 1917, the British army is coming up from Egypt. There are three battles of Gaza, which, again, I think is a forgotten bit of history. In two of them, the British faced the same Turkish army that had defeated them at Gallipoli, many of the same regiments, many of the same men. And the Ottomans knock the British back twice in 1917, just south of Gaza, in Khan Yunis, actually, where the fighting is going on now. And it's only on the third attempt, when the general is replaced by Allenby. And Allenby, in the end, basically goes round via Beersheba, surrounds Gaza, and outflanks the Ottomans, that the Ottoman lines are broken. The British take Jerusalem. And
I think there was a quote at that point where it's the Prime Minister at the time said Christmas came early or
exactly
something like that, right?
Yeah. And I think it's about 2 weeks after the battle, after Beersheba had been taken, after Jerusalem had been captured, that the Balfour Declaration is issued, when not even the whole of Palestine has yet been captured. It's still, I think, Ottoman troops in the north. The battles are still raging and the Ottomans are in retreat, but they're not defeated yet. At that point, Arthur Balfour, the Foreign Secretary, releases the Balfour Declaration, promising a Jewish homeland in Palestine. Apparently oblivious. These guys had never been there, to the fact that, you know, this was a land with a million people living in it already, of whom the Jewish population, which had been there for centuries. And there were areas like Jerusalem and Safed, which were deeply Jewish, and Hebron, where there were old, old Jewish communities. But they were only 10% of the population. Another 10% was Christian, and 80% was Muslim. Those Palestinians were a wide mix of different peoples, ancient Canaanites, ancient Philistines, Arabs who'd arrived in the 7th century, Turks who had come subsequently. Some of the Palestinian Christians have Crusader blood, have Byzantine blood. They were a Levantine people, as people all over the Middle East were, with very mixed ethnicities. Apologists for Israel often give the impression, ignorant of their history, that the Palestinians arrived in the Arab Islamic conquests of the 7th century. That conquest was only a warrior elite, and it only changed the rulers. The people who were tilling the soil, living on the olive groves, farming their land, were the people that had been there in and out. Many of them were previously of the Jewish faith, as well as those who were still practicing the Jewish faith. Many Jews converted to Christianity in the Byzantine period, others later converted to Islam. But the population of Palestine, right up until the Crusades, was majority Christian. And it's only towards the 14th, 15th, and 16th centuries that you get a clear Muslim majority. And at the turn of the century, say about 10% Jewish population, 10% Christian, 80% Muslim, all with very mixed blood, as was true all over the Levant. If you went to Alexandria, if you went to Beirut, if you went to Izmir, Smyrna, you would find again these very mixed populations from a wide variety of different ethnic groups, all intermarrying, all living together, all operating under different systems, and an incredible amount of coexistence. And I think it's very important to point to that too, that between Jewish Palestinians and Muslim Palestinians and Christian Palestinians, if you read the folklore of the period, you find that many of them share sacred spaces. So for example, there was a church in Beit Zahor where the Jewish population came and paid homage to the prophet Elias, the Muslims to Khizr, and the Christians to King George. By the time I got there in the 1980s, the Jewish population had been separated off and become part of Israel, while the Christians and the Muslims shared the sacred space still. And I saw Muslims coming to this Christian church and offering sheep for sacrifice to Khizr, but the priest took them on the basis that Khizr was the same as St. George. So there's this deeply integrated history of Muslim, Christian, and Jew living together. It wasn't always complete peace. It was the Ottoman Empire was a turbulent equilibrium. And occasionally there are moments such as the Damascus massacres in the 1880s when you get inter-communal fighting. But by and large, these peoples live side by side, live together in a measure of peace and coexistence. And there's a whole Palestinian history that, if you look in Ottoman travel accounts, is there, which has been completely erased from the record. So, for example, in the 16th century, there's an Ottoman traveller called Evliya Çelebi. He visits Palestine and he gives an extensive account of the prosperity of this land, of the many rich cities, of the orange growing, of the olives, of the farmland, of the many Sufi shrines and Sufi brotherhoods which he visits in Jerusalem. And so there is a whole mixed Levantine world, as complex and
a lot of it is in your book.
This is very much what I was writing about when I was researching From the Holy Mountain.
Yeah.
As mixed and as porous and as closely interwoven with each other, like a very complicated textile where different strands of different colors are woven into one whole. And what you see all over the Middle East as ideas of nationalism spreads in the 19th century are these closely woven fabrics being torn apart. So the Greeks rise up against the Ottomans and expel the Muslims from there. There are attempts to create an Armenian state which end up in an Armenian genocide. There are attempts to create national units which were very different from the mixed and cosmopolitan populations which existed in Ottoman times. And the most severe, I mean, there are several mass slaughters and mass evictions. The Armenian genocide of 1915 is one. Smyrna massacres of 1923 is another. But the Nakba, which took place at the very last days of the British Mandate, when well-armed Jewish underground are fighting against and expelling Palestinian villagers from their homes and farms. And these are the grandparents and the great-grandparents of the kids whose tents are being burnt in Gaza today. That little girl we saw on our mobile phones last week trying to get out of that burning building, those kids being burnt alive in their tents the week before, all these horrors that we see every week delivered to us, filmed by people and brought into the world, often through Middle East Eye and Al Jazeera, and very rarely by the mainstream media. These are the grandchildren and the great-grandchildren of the people kicked out of their homes in 1948. And the British did nothing, didn't lift a finger to protect these people. All they were worried about was pulling their troops out as safely as they could.
So you're bringing it back to the Britain's responsibility.
This is all a very long answer to Britain's responsibility. Yes.
It's like I'm watching a lecture, but I'm loving it.
Watching a very rambling.
No, not at all. I'm learning lots, but I think just to put it in shorter terms for that specific answer, like if I were to say, I'm trying to, we now get a good glimpse of the history, but if from a historian's perspective and someone like yourself, this idea of Britain's responsibility, when we hear the off time, we hear some politician raising it, it's not common, but when it does come up, what does it mean in your view?
Well, I did think the Palestinians would either be being bombed in Gaza today or even be in Gaza rather than in their homes in the Galilee if the British had not interfered in that country in 1917. If the policy...
You're tying it to that far back.
Absolutely. And if the mandate had not encouraged, as the Balfour Declaration says, Jewish immigration into this land that was already full of a people with their own traditions, their own food, their own dress sense, their own textiles and so on. If the British had not then abandoned the Palestinians in 1917 and then gone on to provide diplomatic support consistently for the Israelis ever since. There have been moments when British governments have thrown up their hands at what the Israelis were doing, and I think the modern Tory party have forgotten that Mrs. Thatcher, in fact, banned arms sales to the Israelis, for example, during their very bloody assault on Lebanon. In the 1980s.
Yeah.
That seems to have been forgotten in the Tory party memory. We see Kemi Badenoch now spreading deeply Islamophobic myths about how the Israelis are somehow fighting a proxy war on our behalf. I mean, what is she saying? Is she subscribing to some sort of millennial evangelical Christian belief that there is a massive war of Islam against the Christian world? Because I hope that's not what she's saying, but that seems to be the sort of language she's coming up with now.
Do you not feel like you're walking a tight rope? I heard you say that anyone, you know, or everyone who supports the Palestinian cause walks a tight rope.
Yes.
No,
obviously. Well, first of all, there's a good reason why people hesitate to talk about Israel-Palestine, because it's a deeply complex issue. The history is very complicated. And the rights and wrongs are very complicated, because the Jewish people have suffered centuries of anti-Semitism, culminating in the Holocaust, when 6 million Jews were put into gas chambers by the Nazis. All this creates an area where there are many moral grey areas. And it's one where people rightly fear to tread unless they know their history and they know their politics very well. But people who have seen what I have seen on the West Bank still feel imperiled to speak out. And it's true that it's very difficult to do so if you're, for example, employed by the BBC. which has sees itself as a duty to remain somehow completely neutral, though it doesn't seem to feel the same duty when dealing with Russian atrocities in Ukraine.
And the problem with the BBC, the criticism towards Israel-Palestine, is that like they say that they're trying to be neutral, trying to be balanced, but at the end of the day, it is an unbalanced war that they're covering.
I know many, many good people working in the BBC, and they all feel very constrained about what they say, and they all feel very alarmed when they're forced, in a sense, to make decisions about news stories, about how they read the scripts they're given, and so on. It is obviously a very difficult thing.
But just on that, what do you feel like it says about the media climate today in the UK?
Well, I have to say I've been extremely disappointed by the BBC News response. There are some people that have spoken out very bravely, and there are some journalists, such as Michelle Hussein on the Today programme, who was very well informed about this conflict, and who asked extremely pertinent and well-researched questions. But in general, you get the impression that most news anchors simply don't have the background in their education to make informed comment about this in the way that they would do about an issue like Brexit or an issue about American foreign policy or something. Anyone that knows the history of this area is aware of how little is known about the history of this region by most people who comment on it, or are forced to anchor the news, or question politicians on the news about it. And so I feel that at the heart of all our problems is a problem of education.
Are you not risking anything? Do you feel like you're risking anything? Do you not think about? Surely you think about these things.
So, first of all, it's not like America.
It's not like America.
You're not going to get ICE turning up in the middle of the night if you write a pro-Palestinian editorial in Britain. You're not going to be put into some distant container in Maryland with no access to lawyers. People feel very passionately about this issue on both sides, and you enter a highly charged atmosphere and a highly divisive subject if you enter this battlefield and if you engage in the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. It's one of the most divisive, one of the most bitter conflicts in the world. My view is that it's your job to speak your truth clearly, factually, and accurately. And if you have a point of view which is informed, which you believe passionately, it's your right to say it. In fact, I certainly believe it's my duty to say what I say. I am completely clear in my own head that what I have seen happen on the West Bank, the way that Palestinians have been treated, means that my motives for fighting for justice are good ones and morally clear ones. I believe it would be immoral to keep quiet, having seen what I've seen, having read what I've read, knowing what I know of the history. And I will continue to speak out. And I'm glad to say that in this country it is possible to speak out. I'm not going to, be hauled away like in America and put in some...
But do you not fear the idea of losing a book deal or, not being able to talk somewhere, or getting
personally...
Because we've seen those examples
as
well.
Yeah, no, for me personally, I have a very good relationship with my publisher, and they're behind me. And I'm not employed by any university or... media organization which is likely to cancel me because of my views. It certainly has happened, and Gary Lineker is the most recent example of someone who clearly was not an anti-Semite, but who lost his job for speaking out clearly on the Palestinian issue. But I just believe it would be immoral for me to sit on my hands and keep quiet, having seen what I've seen, knowing what I know. And I'm nothing special in that way. There are hundreds of other people, thousands of people speaking out. But among the writers of whom I am friends, I have a close-knit group of writers, both Jewish and other faiths, a whole variety of different faiths, who feel equally strongly as I do at the treatment of the Palestinians. Ultimately, what we need to achieve is something like the Northern Ireland peace process, where moderates from both sides can reach together and where they can meet in the middle and find some way to coexist. Whether it's one state, whether it's two states, whether it's a revived Oslo or some completely different setup. But at a period of history when At least 2.1 million Palestinians are threatened with ethnic cleansing and starvation, when it's quite likely from the rhetoric of Ben-Gvir and Smotrich and Netanyahu that not only the West Bank Palestinians do, but even the Arab Israelis may be shoved into a boat and cast out to sea or thrown into the Sinai Desert. In a situation like that, you have to make a moral stand. And I believe that it would be entirely wrong of me to keep quiet in that situation. So I understand that my motives may be misunderstood. I understand that people may accuse me of prejudices which I do not hold. And I realize that what I will say will upset some people. But it is my duty, I think, to say clearly what I believe and what I know to be true. Right.
And let's move on to your book now, From the Holy Mountain. You wrote this, what, in 1997?
1997, it kind of occupied me the whole of the 1990s. This was my big project. And it was not just about the Palestinian Christians, it was about the Christian groups across the Middle East.
Yes.
So it's a journey.
There is a section that deals with Israel-Palestine.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But it's part of a wider project looking at the decline of the Christians in the Middle East. It starts in Turkey with the Armenians and the Suriani, goes through Syria, which at that point under the Assads was a haven of the Middle Eastern Christians, and hopefully will remain so, but these are uncertain times in Syria. Lebanon, where effectively the Maronites had lost their hold on power in the Civil War, and it was a very conflicted time to visit Lebanon. It's always a conflicted time in Lebanon, one way or another, but this in 1994 was a tricky moment in Lebanon's history.
It was, during the Civil War.
Then through Jordan on to Israel-Palestine, and finally, the Copts and the question of the Copts, who are the largest of all the Middle Eastern Christian minorities. But it was the section on the Palestinian Christians that brought me deeply into this whole story. And while I was researching it, living in the old city of Jerusalem, in the Armenian Quarter, it was the first time that I encountered militant settler violence.
And you wrote about it.
And I wrote about it. Yeah. I saw it. I mean, every weekend you could count on groups of settlers coming through past the Armenian Quarter, shouting death to the Arabs, throwing stones, breaking windows, picking fights, beating people up, spitting at people. And combined with that sort of vigilantism in the streets of Jerusalem was a far more organized and professional world of people, land agents trying to seize properties, buying properties covertly from people that would then sort of disappear out of the country, both in the Muslim, the Christian, and the Armenian quarters. And this gradual sense that there was a concerted drive to Judaize a city which had always been a mixed city, always been a city of different faiths coexisting in a measure of pluralism. And watching the violence at that time and hearing those cries to death the Arabs and seeing, you know, Palestinian kids and Palestinians, youths withdrawing into their shops or behind their shutters when settler groups would come through with machine guns and often
which hasn't stopped till this day.
Which is accelerating.
Yeah, exactly. It's only increased.
You get a very clear picture, which is rarely shown in television. The big exception recently has been Louis Theroux's documentary on the settlers, of this militant nationalism, which is actively and in an organized fashion driving indigenous people out of their farms. And you go to the West Bank and it looks like Tuscany. It looks like you could be, you know, somewhere near San Gimignano with olive groves and vineyards.
I have the quote. You said the West Bank, and this is a quote, "Astonishing, unexpected beauty of the West Bank's dry, stony hills." That's how you describe
absolutely
it.
Absolutely gorgeous. And what I was writing about was these desert monasteries, as well as the lay Christian communities. So I would go off to Mar Theodosius or Mar Saba, these very, very ancient monasteries which dated back to the very early days of the earliest Christians in the 1st, 2nd, 3rd, 4th century AD. And again, you were
stopped by an Israeli soldier. There was a section that you also wrote about.
There's several.
But you can't go anywhere,
obviously, in this region without coming across checkpoints and having to explain yourself four times or five times a day. Some of them I wrote about in the book.
But there was one time I think you were trying to enter a settlement, and then a soldier stopped you, an Israeli soldier, and then he asked you if you had Arab friends, which is a term that the Israelis use for Palestinians, and then he asked you if you knew any terrorists, I believe, and if they wanted you to do anything inside the settlement.
This is anyone that's ever been there gets these questions at the airport, at immigration, every day in the streets.
But, I read that section, and then after everything, he kind of just said that, you're free to go, or there's been a confusion or something. And then you end that paragraph by saying, but he didn't apologize.
No, like in Northern Ireland, both groups believe that they are in the right. Like in Northern Ireland, both groups believe that they are the ones with the true claim to the land, and that they both claim to be the victims. But I take enormous hope from the fact that the Northern Ireland peace process, for all its flaws, has basically led to the coexistence of two different peoples. And we never ended up with a situation whereby the Catholics of West Belfast were ever likely to be ethnically cleansed. In Palestine, we are in that situation now. 2.1 million Palestinians stand to be ethnically cleansed if Netanyahu gets his way, if Trump gets his idea of his Riviera from which Palestinians are to be excluded. This is where we are. So now is the time to stand up and be counted. We can't just sit back and watch this happening. If you know what's going on, you've got to stand up. And that I reach out to all my friends who are wanting coexistence, of which that includes many Israeli and Jewish friends who otherwise might not be, natural supporters of Middle East Eye, to join together and stop this ethnic cleansing and encourage coexistence. And luckily, I mean, there are huge numbers of people out there who do want coexistence. Inevitably, after the 7th of October, after the Hamas atrocities, after those horrors and murders, there has been massive polarization and everyone has been radicalized on both sides. Since the slaughter in Gaza, the Palestinians are also feeling that there can be no hope of any coexistence. And we recently had that poll in Haaretz that said that, 82% of Israelis want the people of Gaza cleared out? And a fair number, 30%, something like that, that you want even the Arab Israelis, the Israeli
Palestinian citizens of Israel.
Palestinian citizens of Israel to also be cleared out. But things calm down. As we know in the Middle East, there have been moments of terrific violence and terrific interreligious bloodshed. And things can calm down and a middle path can be found. And I'm still not convinced that if we can knock some sense and put some pressure on Netanyahu and knock some sense into Trump and his government, that there is not still some hope of coexistence. I haven't in any way given up for that yet.
I mean, who knows what the future holds? I think the focus, as you've highlighted several times during this interview, is just to stop the bloodshed.
Stop bloodshed. As the first case.
Yeah, but let me read you another quote from the Holy Mountain, because you mentioned Christians, and this is one that stuck out to me. Few Western Christians are aware of the degree of hardship faced by their co-religionists in the Holy Land, and the West's often uncritical support of Israel frankly baffles the Palestinian Christians who feel their position being eroded year by year.
Correct.
Now, I think of this in the context of Palestinian Christians in Gaza. I mean, Gaza has the third oldest church in the world, which was bombed by Israel in the last 18 months.
In the Byzantine time, Gaza, which we think of as this sort of disaster zone, was one of the richest ports of the region. Gaza and Tyre were the two big ports between the third and the seventh century, were the two richest ports on that coast. And fragments of that world still survive, including the Greek Orthodox Church. this Byzantine Greek state still stands. And you're right, some of the outbuildings were shelled last year. The main church still amazingly survives, the old structure from the 4th century, I think.
Yeah, just about. The reason why I bring it up is that I think of how, you know, about what, 30 years, almost 30 years have passed, sorry to be blunt about the time, but it goes back to this idea of how I'm sure Palestinian Christians are thinking of how, you know, Western Christians aren't looking at them or supporting them in that way.
Some of Israel's most implacable supporters are
Christian Zionists.
Are Christian Zionists,
sure.
Often of an evangelical background, who see the return of the Jews to Israel, yes, as part of some biblical prophecy that will lead to Armageddon and to the final days, the unfolding of the last judgment. Now, that's not a theology which many in this country would recognize, and certainly my own Catholic Church does not subscribe to that that version of Christianity. But it is a powerful political force in America. The current American ambassador to Israel, I believe,
Huckabee
is part of that whole world. So yes, so I think it's very important, which is why one of the reasons I wrote this book was to emphasize that 10% of Palestinians are Christian, and they've suffered along with their Muslim cousins and brothers. And one of the things I did in this book was to look at the villages where the Palestinian Christians had fled from or been driven out of in 1948. And there's one particular one called Kfar Barim, which is on the...
It's where Samira's from.
Exactly.
One of the people you spoke to. Yeah.
And so I first came across this name when I went to a Palestinian refugee camp in Beirut and talked to Palestinian Christians, who are the minority within the minority of the minority. So they're the refugees from Palestine who got driven into Lebanon, but they're not Muslim, they're Christian. They're not Maronites like the Lebanese Christians. They're often usually Greek Orthodox. And so they're a very small world within a world. But they told me about their village, Kfar Barim, and then I went there. And what happened was that this village, the people I met in Beirut had actually been living in Haifa in 1948 and never got to go back home. They had their jobs in Haifa. And so they lost everything in the village when the Israelis bombed the village in 1948. Many of the villagers remained there and then got moved out in 1948 and took refuge in Nazareth and other Christian towns. And were no longer allowed to go back to this village, which got turned into a national park. When you go there today, their stables and their yards and the houses they lived in have antiquities plaques saying this is Second Temple period. There is a Second Temple period synagogue in the heart of the village that has always been there and is always part of this mosaic of different cultures which existed in Palestine before the British. But the Christians now are told that this is a historic monument and it's presented to people like a sort of Pompeii, like something surviving from the Roman period. And they can now pay at the gate of this monument and go in and visit their old homes where these signs are up, giving the impression that this entire the ruins in this valley are all from ancient Israelite history, rather than something that was being inhabited until 1948.
And you, again, that's another thing that you deal with in the book is how archaeology and history is being used as a political tool by the Israeli government.
So in any archaeological site, there's a decision to be made about, in a sense, what you display to the public, because it's in the nature of archaeology that there are many different layers. There's the present, the 18th century, the 15th century, the medieval period, before it, the earlier periods. But what happens now in Israel is that they dig down through all the Ottoman period, through the Byzantine period, and just present the rediscovery of the Jewish past. There's one period of history which is privileged at the expense of all the others. And what was also very clear in my research at the time was that there is money available to preserve important Jewish remains, which are put up and open to the public, and you have amazing synagogues from the first, second century. But equally, alongside that, there was a case of, in a complex that was discovered next to Damascus Gate on the edge of the old city of Jerusalem. The synagogues were preserved, but the Armenian chapel had the road built over it and was not saved. The mosaic was lifted and taken off to a museum. It was recorded. It wasn't that it was just sort of disappeared. It's there in the archaeological record. But as a tourist, when you walk past it today, there's a synagogue and there's a road where the Armenian church was.
And it's to give an impression that Jerusalem has had a predominantly Jewish population in the past.
And indeed, you know, the government effort is to show it almost as an exclusively Jewish.
Exclusively, yes.
Which is never true. It was always a pluralistic town. There was always a Jewish presence, but there was also from the early Christian period, a Christian presence, and from the 7th century, a Muslim presence. And that is the glory of the Levant. It is this incredibly mixed world where different religions, different ethnic groups all managed to form some sort of coexistence. And we have to somehow retrieve something from that wreckage. We need the Palestinians to have the same security that the Israelis have. We need to persuade these two people somehow to live side by side. It all is not lost. It is still possible to imagine a world where coexistence can, as it happens in London. You know, we have people of every different faith living in every street in this city. Contrary to some of the kind of Fox News sort of propaganda about sort of, you know, whole areas of London being no-go areas, as anyone who lives here knows, it is the most fabulously multicultural city where people, by and large, get on very well with each other. That is possible again, and I don't think we should despair. There are periods of history when people have embraced very extreme ideologies, and then that moment passes, and history rolls on, and people learn to live together. If you look at the history of the regions around Israel-Palestine, look at somewhere like Syria, there have been moments of great bloodshed, but there's also been moments of peace, long periods of peaceful coexistence. So,
speaking of history, yeah. Let me actually, because I'd be remiss not to have one question about the subcontinent, but what parallels can we draw between partition and the Nakba?
So in both the British, well, not only in partition in India, Pakistan, but in Cyprus and in Northern Ireland, the same legislation was issued in Westminster. Very similar legislation was issued to partition. And in all four examples, it led to enduring conflict. So, I mean, Northern Ireland is the unique one now in that there is a measure of peace. But there's still a very taut and difficult border in Cyprus. India and Pakistan just fought a war 4 months ago on the Kashmir border. And we've seen another conflict this year, on not only within Israel and with Gaza, but also in Lebanon and in Syria. So there are many disturbing parallels. The same generation of Brits partitioned both countries. In both cases, the British withdrew, leaving the people's at conflict to fight it out without British intervention. The difference is that while the Hindus driven out of Pakistan had India to go to, the Palestinians have never had their own state in which to feel secure, to find a national home. And we have to find some way for the Palestinians to have a fate other than ethnic cleansing, other than occupation, other than subjugation. It's not right that a Palestinian farmer in the West Bank can have a Molotov cocktail in his garage, have his olive groves cut down by extremist settlers fresh from Brooklyn. It's not right that they can be driven off their land and forced to have their houses knocked down by bulldozers and JCBs. It's clearly wrong. We have to find a way to get the two people to live together. I keep repeating myself, but it is the only feasible solution. The other alternative is the ethnic cleansing of 5 million people. There are currently within the borders of Israel at the moment. There are whatever it is, 7 million Jewish Israelis and 5 million Palestinians. It's just not feasible to imagine a world where 5 million Palestinians are driven out into exile, ethnically cleansed from their lands. There has to be a middle way, and there has to be an effort from this government in this country to force the moderates on both sides to come together.
My last question, even though I could sit here for hours, listen to you, what do you think future historians will write about this moment in time? How do you think they're gonna look back? I know you don't have a crystal ball, and I'm not asking you to bring one up, but I don't know if this is a thought that you have.
I have no doubt that this is going to be one of those seminal moments that historians will dwell on for centuries to come, just like we look back to 1948 and examine
watershed.
What happened as a watershed. This is another of those moments of crisis. The Palestinians are not yet driven out of Gaza. Their buildings have been destroyed, their houses have been leveled, their physical infrastructure has been completely smashed to bits. But Berlin rose from the ashes, Beirut rose from the ashes. Cities can recover, and Gaza can come back to life. And we have to hope for a better future where extremists on both sides are not murdering each other in large numbers.
And on that note, Willem Dalrymple, thank you so much
you.
For coming on Real Talk. I appreciate you inviting us to your house as well.
Thank you.
And for the tea.
Thank you.
Thank you so much, sir.